Thank you very much for being here. We're at the home stretch of the conference and of today, and it's great to see a lot of people here for this important topic. Thank you for the HIV section, for organizing this topic, and for me, it's an incredibly humbling privilege to be on panel with some of my heroes, Ken and Steph. So I'll be speaking of MSM, sexual minorities, in the context of policy, what all this means for domestic-related policies as well as international and U.S. foreign assistance. I have no relationship to disclose. So as we know, U.S. is the largest funder of global AIDS programming in the world. If you look at the graph here, this is from Kaiser. In 2009, U.S. funding for global AIDS programming accounted for nearly 58% of all spending from around the world. If you look at the disbursements from 2002 to 2008, you see that there's been a six-fold increase. Sorry? Oh, yeah. From 2002 to 2008, there's been a six-fold. Oh, I see it now. From 2002 to 2008, there's been a six-fold increase in HIV funding from the U.S. And of course, it's leveled off between 2008 and 2009. But nonetheless, the U.S. remains the largest funder of global AIDS programming. In terms of programming, the majority of the funding goes to bilateral programming known as PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, as well as the Global Fund. And the Global Fund is a multilateral agency that gives money to governments to do HIV programming, TB programming, as well as malaria programming. And despite these unparalleled resource commitments, as Steph has pointed out, this is a chart from UNAIDS, most at-risk populations continue to be marginalized, and service coverage for these populations, and this is just looking at Africa, continue to be out of reach. Situation is the same in the U.S. If you look at funding between 2006 and 2011, HIV funding for federal programming is on the slope of increase, and while funding has leveled off nearly close to 2010 and FY 2011, as recent CDC data shows, men who have sex with men continue to be a large majority of the population, accounting for nearly over 23,000 infections in 2008. This graph shows diagnosis of HIV infection among adult and adolescent males by transmission category. In 2008, 72%, 23,000 of all diagnosed HIV infections among adult and adolescent males were attributed to male-to-male sexual contact. This is in the United States. So what's happening here? U.S. is the largest funder of global AIDS programming, as Dr. Mayer and Dr. Baral have laid out. The infection continues to spread among marginalized populations. What is happening here, and what is the role of U.S. foreign assistance? If you look at the Global Fund, and this is research that I don't think has been published yet, and this is looking at analysis of signed grants in round 8. So the Global Fund goes through these rounds of funding, and we're at round 10-ish now. So this is about a couple years back. They've analyzed budgets for round 8, and this is just the first phase. If you look at the proportion of funding, only 9% of all funding for the first phase of round 8 goes to MARPs. And MARPs, and this includes sex workers, injecting drug users, as well as MSM. Of that 9%, MSM is a mere just 2% of all signed budgets for the Global Fund. PEPFAR, which is the largest funder of HIV programming around the world, we see similar trends. This is a report that MFAR released at the Vienna AIDS Conference in July, and some of the key themes from that report, analyzing the PEPFAR's response, we looked at eight countries with a variety of different epidemic and geographic contexts. The story is the same. Incomplete epidemiological data. Many governments do not include MSM in their routine HIV data collection and reporting, and so we have incomplete epidemiological data. Limited service coverage. Many of the implementing partners that we spoke to of PEPFAR and many of the NGO community partners that we spoke to reported woefully inadequate program coverage for MSM, and as Steph has laid out in his expenditure reporting. Another key theme is that the civil society is a key driver in this force of change. What I mean by that is in many of these situations, many of these contexts, the only access to MSM programming that exists is because of a local community-based programming. And that aspect of it remains critical in terms of in thinking of policy moving forward. And widespread criminalization and severe punishment remains a key deterrent, as Steph has laid out. So if you look at PEPFAR and the top 20 countries receiving PEPFAR funding, No, actually. You know, I've been changing my slides all morning, and it looks like they're still out of slides. But anyway, we can continue this way. Certainly over the last year, and as Steph alluded to, there have been a slew of homophobic rhetoric and violence, and as well as criminalizing legislative efforts throughout the world that have garnered international attention. These things have been going on for a long time, but they're garnering international media attention in Senegal. These are just some examples. South Africa, Kenya, Jamaica, Zimbabwe, Uganda, Malawi. So if you look at the top 20 PEPFAR country programs, these are the top 20 countries receiving PEPFAR funding. You'll see that there's a range from Africa as well as from Haiti, Vietnam, some in the Asian Pacific area as well, and Russia. If you look at the top 20 PEPFAR countries receiving PEPFAR dollars, and this accounts for some 85% of all PEPFAR dollars, you'll see that nearly 7 of the top 10 PEPFAR countries penalize same-sex acts. And if you expand it to all 12 out of 20 of the PEPFAR funded programming countries penalize same-sex acts. Situation is similar for the Global Fund. If you look at the top 20 countries receiving Global Fund dollars, 6 out of the 10 countries penalize same-sex acts, and there's some overlap, as you can see. And if you expand to the top 20, 11 out of 20 of those top Global Fund countries penalize same-sex acts. So what does this mean? Actually, all told, some 76 countries around the world have criminalizing laws on the books for same-sex acts. A majority of these countries are in Africa, some 38 countries in Africa, but it's not just concentrated in Africa. Steph has pointed out some of the top 5 countries that have the death penalty for same-sex acts include Iran, Mauritania, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Yemen. So here's a chart from UNAIDS analyzing the 2008 UNGAS indicators. And as you may know, every 2 years, the United Nations requires countries to report on a variety of HIV-AIDS related activities called UNGAS indicators. And they happen every 2 years. And the 2010 UNGAS indicators were released a few months ago. But here's a chart based on the 2008 UNGAS indicators. And I think it's very telling. If you look at the y-axis looks at median percentage of population reached with HIV prevention services, and that looks like we're looking at sex workers, injecting drug users, and men who have sex with men. The dark red represents countries having non-discriminated laws, and the pinkish, I guess, or peach, countries reporting not having laws that protect not discriminating law and regulations with protections for sexual minorities. If you look at MSM, service coverage for MARPs are considerably higher in settings where protection does exist. And of course, this is just one side of the story, because it's not just about laws, right? Penal laws are one thing, but as we know, homophobia exists in all countries. And if you look at Guatemala, for example, Guatemala does not penalize same-sex acts. They're not one of the 76 countries that penalize male-to-male sexual activity, although reporting has suggested that deep homophobia and transphobia has been reported, and that has interrupted a lot of HIV programming in Guatemala. So far, it looks, according to this report, but this is actually the International HIV AIDS Alliance, 13 transgender people were murdered in Guatemala in the first half of 2010. And the situation in the U.S., of course, as we all know, Tyler Clementi, who committed suicide just a few weeks ago, similar situations there. In the U.S., we've been talking about the global laws, but in the U.S., of course, there are no federal laws that consistently protect LGBT individuals from employment discrimination. I was hoping that the legend would be here, but the different colors represent various different protections for sexual orientation and gender identity. But the point here is are the gray countries, the gray states, excuse me. Employment discrimination is technically legal in 21 states in the U.S. based on sexual orientation, and those are the gray states that you see here. And 38 states do so based on gender identity as well. And so what are the policy implications for the U.S.? So what is the role of policy, knowing that LGBT rights are human rights, as Secretary Clinton has said numerous times? And that we know that the reduction of HIV among the MSM is a vital component of an evidence-based response, as Steph has pointed out, and as well as a global health response, and as well as the U.S.'s ability to reach Millennium Development Goals, and for countries to reach their Millennium Development Goals. What is the role of policy? If you look at foreign policy first, as Secretary Clinton again has said, diplomacy and development go hand in hand, right? And so, as we saw from the PEPFAR countries, the majority of the funding we give to countries that penalize same-sex acts. In Uganda, for example, the Parliament of Uganda had an anti-homosexuality law in October of 2009-ish. You may have recall this. Do folks know about the story in Uganda? Yeah? Okay. In the House of Representatives, Congressman Berman put out a resolution condemning the anti-homosexuality law. And from what we know, a lot of behind-the-scenes diplomatic efforts from the U.S. and also international pressure eventually put the anti-homosexuality bill to rest, although there are some stories about it coming back up in other forms. But in this situation, diplomatic pressure worked for Uganda. And so there is a role to encourage the criminalization of same-sex acts and to encourage the repeal of laws and policies that reinforce stigma and discrimination. This is for U.S. foreign policy. Malawi. The point here is that we have to ensure there is a role in policy, in U.S. foreign policy, but it's incredibly critical to let the local community efforts and the community groups give us clues about how to respond. And so, for example, in Malawi, two individuals were arrested late 2009 again, and eventually their arrest, the trial, the conviction, and then their eventual pardon in the early parts of this year garnered huge media attention. For everyone from Madonna was also involved, and she had her own action alert to get people to write to the Malawian government. The point here is, and as Steph has pointed out, a lot of this has led to disruption to HIV services for community groups on the ground who were reaching MSM and other sexual minorities. And so it's been better now, but if you talk to people on the ground, a lot of this has made their work more, the international tension has made their work more difficult. So it's important to take to clues from community-based groups. What is the role for donors and donor policy? In the U.S., there's what's called the Global Health Initiative, and more we're hearing of country ownership and strengthening of public health systems. What does this mean for sexual minorities and for vulnerable groups who, as we saw in those 20 countries of PEPFAR and Global Fund, whose countries don't actually acknowledge their existence? And so, as Steph has pointed out, donors and policymakers must ensure that services are tailored and best met to meet the needs of vulnerable populations, and sometimes that means services outside of the public health sector and that are connected to the public health sector but are separate in a way. And of course, supporting community-based efforts because they're the ones who know the population, they know they have access to hidden populations, and that needs to be a critical part of any foreign policy, and of course the Global Health Initiative as well. So this is such a, I think this was in the Washington Post, it was in the Washington Post May of this year. The point here is, of course, we have to, for our foreign policy to work, we have to ensure that our own domestic policy is also in line with human rights principles as well, right? And there are a number of issues here in the U.S. In July of 2010, as many of you know, President Obama released a national HIV/AIDS strategy. In the strategy, he noted that gay and bisexual men of all races are the only groups in the U.S. where the estimated number of new infections is rising annually. This is a quote from the national HIV strategy. And the national HIV strategy includes many, many great things, including the implementation of laws that promote public health practice and underscore the existing best evidence in HIV prevention for sexual minorities. Now, this is great, and now federal agencies are putting together different plans to ensure that they're all in line with the national HIV, so there's a huge role to play for public health professionals to ensure that these provisions in the strategy are realized. Structural interventions, again, Steph spoke to this. Creating anti-stigma, anti-discrimination, anti-bullying initiatives targeting homophobia and transphobia are critical. This is, Ken, you may remember this from the Washington Post when you were in D.C. during the HIV-MSM meeting. The point here is more important than ever, we need to ensure that there are a diverse set of stakeholders involved in programming, because sometimes this initiative here, which was out of the U.S. Department of Education, it's targeting anti-gay bullying in the schools, but guess, you know, there might be a indirect impact to HIV prevention efforts down the road. And so, you know, we need to think outside of the HIV box and involving other stakeholders from other areas and other departments within the U.S. government as well. APHA policy, here at this annual conference, the International Health Section, in partnership with the HIV section, as well as LGBT caucus, the Latino caucus, and public health nursing section, proposed a late-breaking policy resolution here, prioritizing the health of MSM and the global HIV response. This was a late breaker, and so as you may know, there's a whole process where you can get a policy resolution submitted. If it's after February 2010, you could do a late breaker. There needs to be compelling evidence to demonstrate the need for a late breaker. Otherwise, they encourage you to go through the process next year. Unfortunately, this policy resolution was not approved. I'm going to be dramatic because I'm still upset. The point that the Joint Policy Committee made is that there was not enough compelling evidence for the policy resolution to go through the late-breaking process this year, but they encouraged us to go through the policy next. And we will, and of course our sections will get together, but there's a role to play, of course, for public health associations. Sorry for being dramatic, but. Lastly, in thinking of the HIV/AIDS response, here's a study that AMFAR just released yesterday afternoon. It's important to be mindful of the political climate, right? The shifting political climate in Congress will have huge ramifications for not just HIV programming, but also for foreign assistance. Many of the newly elected members of Congress have won based on the platform of cutting government funding, cutting government spending, and reducing global engagement in the world. So what does this all mean for HIV programming? Speaker-elect Boehner, who will take over the House of Representatives on January 5th, has proposed going back to FY08 levels for funding. And so we did an analysis looking at what this means for domestic and global HIV programming. That would mean a 6.5% cut in all HIV funding for the U.S., and this is across the board, CDC, HRSA, and the other funding streams, and 13.1% cut in funding for global programming to the PEPFAR and the Global Fund. So domestically, what does this mean? 4,300 people will need to be removed from ADAP, adding to the 4,000 who are already on the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, so doubling that number. NIH would be cut by 8%. Bilateral HIV/AIDS programming through the PEPFAR program would be cut by 12%. So it's just important to be mindful of the political environment. All to say, and I'll leave you with my friend Stephanie, who was on the front page of the Washington Post. This was December 2 last year after World AIDS Day. More important than ever, I think the HIV/AIDS response, as you all know, is at a critical crossroads. We have exciting and emerging clinical interventions, which will soon report exciting new data. This is being met with tightening budgets and threats to even cut HIV programming and foreign assistance programming. All to say that our voice will be critical. It'll be more important than ever to ensure that the HIV/AIDS response remains robust and ensure that the response is addressing the needs of MSM and other sexual minorities. It's going to be more important than ever to demonstrate that this is an important issue for all public health professionals, and this is for all domestic HIV programming as well. So that's it. Thank you very much.
A very appropriate photo to keep up there. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your wonderful presentations. We have about a half an hour to have a discussion, and I'll take questions for any of the panelists. Tom.
Policies like China, for example, And I've heard that they are actually investing in prevention for MSM.
Sure. Okay. So I think what we've
one of the points that
So thanks for that question. So, you know, when we first started doing this data, when we was doing these studies about 4 years ago, we thought that if we did studies from representative countries, and so we started with Malawi, South Africa, but we did it outside the, in the townships to be more sort of representative outside of, because Cape Town is like San Francisco, you know, I mean, we did it in Malawi, Namibia, Botswana, and like I said, South Africa. And we thought that we could then make the case to other countries to sort of, you know, you don't necessarily need to do not every country needs to do one of these studies in their own within their own borders to be able to start making the case that this is something that you should start prioritizing. But that wasn't the case. That's not what happened. And so, for example, I'm going to Zambia on Saturday, and there we're going to make the case for they need a study. Even though there's data from all their bordering countries, it's not an issue in Zambia until there's data from Zambia. So that's been part of the issue. I mean, the question that you had, I mean, low and middle income countries represents the majority of this world. So in lots of different places, there's lots of different responses. In Latin America and the Caribbean, there's lots of countries. There's a few countries where the responses have been very progressive and have been very domestically owned. I think that what we're looking at prevention expenditures in terms of outcomes is that MSM, both domestically and internationally, are like the one population that we've never significantly curbed the epidemic anywhere, right? I mean, it is literally, and that holds true in all the places. And China, this is sort of a long conversation about China's response. China has a concentrated epidemic among MSM, and in some parts has injecting drug use in the Golden Triangle area. So I think they're recognizing that, you know, they want to do all the biomedical interventions as well. They want their own vaccine trials, and they want their own PrEP trials, and they want those things, and they need high incidence cohorts. And so they're developing them everywhere, and they're scaling them up everywhere. So whether they're taking like a rights affirming approach is I don't know that they are. I'd say that they're likely not. But they are, you know, starting to do these studies. What we want them to do next is to start engaging communities, start implementing, you know, interventions that go past just handing out condoms and actually, like I said, engaging communities and understanding what needs are. But in the settings in which we work, we work with community partners in every place that we go. So it's not me out there collecting data. I'm sometimes invited to go out to bars and hang out and meet people and do some of the dissemination, but it's locally owned in terms of local community groups, and we train them to do these research projects because they're the only ones that have access. And so in that sense, it's domestically owned. But what we also do is facilitate. So in this setting, it's me presenting these data. If you'd been at more international conferences, it's the community groups themselves that present the data. And they do that because it provides a platform for them to have a conversation with their policymakers and their HIV/AIDS programmers in their countries. And so I think that conversation in some places like Malawi has actually been a very productive conversation. You know, the issues around the arrest sort of stopped those conversations, and now they're back and sort of happening again. But it's very country specific, and it's been involving me, but there's a whole team of people now doing it, like schlepping from place to place and working with community and trying to build community to be able to do these studies, engage their governments, have data, and then, you know, apply for funding from AMFAR and the MSM Initiative and other funding sources to then advocate for prevention programs. So it's a big continent, and so it's taking a long time. But yeah. Yeah.
Question. There was a poster actually about MSM research in China at this conference, and it stated that the prevalence among MSM had doubled in the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
That's
right. So the way that they've put out a few pieces about this, and I don't want to take too much time, but in China specifically, they've done a series of they don't have any cohorts, they've done a series of cross-sectional studies. And China's a big place, but yet the way that they've put forward their data is that they've developed incidence data from their cross-sectional data, even though the samples aren't the same. And so they're saying that these new samples that have higher rates of higher prevalence rates imply increasing rates of incidence. I think that what a lot of us feel is that they're actually getting deeper into communities, accessing high-risk men, and really sort of uncovering what likely is their epidemic, which is a very concentrated epidemic among MSM. And it's something as well that we know to be true. When we look at men, so, you know, I showed you rates in all MSM, but when we look in a place like Namibia,
and we the 30 to 49 year old group that we access, it's like 50-60% HIV positive rates, right, in all countries. And so, you know, we've only been able to access 18 to 25 year old men because in majority of settings in Africa, they're, and in China too, I mean, they're married and they have kids and they don't really want to partake in these studies at this particular stage and where we are right now. And so we need to better understand how to what the real risk is among these men. But like I said, in the majority of these settings, and in China as well, that when you get at older men, it's showing that it's not a new epidemic. It's been there forever. We're just starting to sort of get into it and delve into it. And it's not new in any place, except Russia is the one place that we think that it's new because of people increased migration and people being able to move around. It's the one place where we've done effective surveillance and we see higher rates among younger MSM. But I think that's sort of a unique perspective related to, you know, the Iron Curtain and all those sort of things. So.
Yes, sir.
So, not always, and not even importantly, but perhaps foundationally, a lot of this stigma and a friend of this comes from some religious foundations. Not always, and not uniformly. So, I'm wondering about your reflections about that, and I would suggest that from the perspective of the LGBT Anglican community, a lot of us have been involved with these in the African context, as well as the local context of this country, as have other. So I want to hear reflections about that issue, but also encourage the section next year, especially under that theme of community, to see if it can infuse that discussion and anthropological, cultural insight, as well as behavioral insight, because the theme of community might really help us advance this discussion.
Who would like to address this?
Sure, I can start. Just to say that I totally agree. I mean, I think the point I was trying to make with the anti-bullying slide is, you know, the challenge for this community and for our work is to appeal to a broader range of stakeholders that are not just HIV, that are not just MSM, that are not just LGBT, but they're faith-based leaders, they're the private sector, and I think you know that. Is I think very important, and I totally agree. It's what you know. It's a challenge for me on a day-to-day basis in Washington when, you know, we do events and we do meetings around these issues. You look around the room and it's the same eight people who come to all the MSM HIV events. But you know, we have to challenge ourselves to appeal and to a broader stake of people, but also get them involved in the work. So totally agree. And leading up to next year, I agree. And we should also think about that in terms of resubmitting the policy resolution. When we come back to the different sections, think of how that implies there as well. We might want to separate the different policy issues. So.
Yeah, I think you hit on something really, really important, and it's complex. So certainly there are champions in Africa, like Desmond Tutu has been very vociferously, you know, standing up to the institutionalized homophobia in some of the other churches. It becomes a very complex cultural dialogue, and I think Steph alluded to some of the work that they're doing, which I think is so important, which is engaging local community groups, because I do think that as external people to, saying to the church that, you know, your values are wrong is sort of a non-starter. So that's part of, you know, in terms of this kind of cultural engagement, that's part of why I'm naively optimistic that one place where we can gain more traction is with healthcare workers, because I do think that that the priors should be, if they're taking a Hippocratic oath, that it's about the health of the individual. And if you can allow them to see how certain social and structural forces are impeding people's health, and from a public health basis, really making epidemics more covert and more intractable, then hopefully they can become allies. And perhaps within individual settings, they may be a more logical bridge to be having an engagement with people in the faith community.
Right. So, yeah. So religious leaders. So in each of the places where we've done dissemination meetings, is always, you know, representatives from faith-based organizations that are there. A lot of them in the settings in which I work run on this as like a political agenda. And and we also know that internationally, faith-based organizations is sort of an issue around PEPFAR, the version one of PEPFAR, was that they were incredibly powerful. right? They knew how to channel the funding. So when PEPFAR 2 is around and global funds, civil society mechanisms, they're the groups that are best organized to draw a lot of the resources and actually be sort of supposedly representatives of civil society. So from that sense, we need to try to figure out how to engage them because they're really controllers of these funds, especially global fund money, and now to a lesser extent PEPFAR money. In terms of what needs to happen, I think Ken really highlighted it, which is that you need local champions. You need like well-respected local champions and not like Muzungus running around like in African sites sort of talking about why this needs to happen. And when we've had that, and we have had that, so we did a study in Lesotho, for example, and at the dissemination meeting earlier this summer, or I should say during the summer, I presented the data. And then like I sat down, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was there, and the Ministry of Justice was there, and the Ministry of Health representatives, and the NAC, the National AIDS Council, were there. And then faith-based organizations. And it just started. I didn't say anything. It was like 3.5 hours, and I didn't say a word. And also, they changed to Sesotho. I didn't even understand anything. And so it was a clear discussion being owned locally, and I think that was very powerful. And when we've had that, like in Senegal, when we have the head of the National AIDS Council there, Dr. Ndoye, is very supportive and also very religious. And so, it's about how he's sort of talked to us about how to engage religious leaders. One-on-one, we can normally find allies. So in Senegal, for example, where it's 95% Muslim, they've had, powerful imams, just like in South Africa, Desmond Tutu has been a powerful advocate. Another layer to this is that a lot of the community groups that we work with, the LGBT community groups, are themselves very religious. And so they've figured out how, in the African context, to reconcile being gay and being very religious. And I think we need to learn how they've done that and sort of figure out how to then convince others that, you can still be very religious and still have your sexual preferences exactly the way that you want. And the two are not mutually exclusive. So I don't know that we have the answer of doing it. The way that we put forward in our structural interventions are one-on-one meetings with, religious leaders. How do you evaluate that is a very complex issue, and it's something that, we don't know how to do just yet. But nonetheless, it's an important component. Those one-on-one meetings with the Office of the President, those one-on-one meetings with high-level religious leaders, and focusing on public health issues and likely staying away from more sort of pure rights issues and taking more of a public health approach with them. So.
Next question. Yes, sir.
In places like Uganda where there's extreme homophobia, white homophobia, what are starting places for, I guess, now for people that sort of engage communities?
Uganda's a very interesting place, right? In Uganda, the community groups there, there's lots of community groups. There's like sexual minorities of Uganda, SMUG, and then there's like four different community groups that all are sort of going about this in different ways. Some have been very vocal, and they're, the three guys that, there was the PEPFAR implementation meeting in Uganda in 2009, and there was three LGBT rights activists sort of protesting outside and were all arrested. So there's people who have taken that approach, and then there's other people that we work with there that have taken an approach of, of more of a public health approach. And I think that both are necessary. In Uganda, there's now a study that was released in Vienna, the CRANE study, which was done by the CDC Uganda, by the American CDC, but based in Uganda, showing that, MSM represent the second highest risk group among all populations in Uganda, with about 13.5% prevalence among MSM. Using RDS, like using respondent-driven sampling, and high rates of syphilis, and high rates of discrimination. So, that to some extent is going to appease, the public health people in Uganda, which it's a very powerful community. This is a country that has been doing public health interventions for HIV since like 86. PMTCT, treatment, et cetera. So people there get it, But then there's this other thing that you guys probably saw with this Rolling Stone magazine just like a week and a half ago where they published did you guys hear about this? Pictures of 100 gay men. This magazine was created just to do this. It didn't exist about a month ago, but just basically published pictures of 100 gay men and their names and what they do for a living. And they're like, go out and target these men. And they have been targeted. And so you're sort of dealing with, and it's interesting because it's a young crowd doing it. It's like a young 18-year-old crowd that's leading this very violent effort. So, I think that the approach to say, moving forward, the approach is based on data for the public health people and both sort of quiet advocacy, but also some people going out there and putting their lives on the line and saying that, you know, we deserve this. And that's sort of what I was talking about, that we have seen community empowerment. Like the fact that there is an LGBT community in Uganda, whereas 10 years ago, there was nothing. Like when I was there as a medical student, and it was when the Red Pepper in like 2002, when the Red Pepper first published the names of gay men, and nobody had even heard of the people were pretending not to have heard about the concept of MSM. So now people are discussing it, you know, and that to some extent has been productive, but has had pushback. So it's, you know, it's come both ways. If others would like to, I mean,
anything else you want to add, gentlemen?
Yes.
A major dilemma, but I think that you know, male sexuality as well as female sexuality, transgender sexuality, are all, you know, socially constructed. So it's really important to each country. There's not going to be one easy solution. So I think a lot of this is this iterative process of you know, clinicians observing people of a certain group getting sick, people who are you know, cultural researchers understanding how you know, where are people meeting, because we know that you know, their sex is the one global given that people are going to be having sex, and trying to understand the different sexual subcultures, and that may mean individual key informant interviews to be able to eventually develop a coherent strategy. And some of this again means that that places that have a different context may have to be places where some of the early engagement and interventions occur. So I do a lot of work in India, and we certainly know that there's a substantial number of men who have sex with men who are married. And so some of the first line interventions have, you know, are based in you know, cruising places, because people are not necessarily going to go to a bar, and they're not going to be willing to give, you know, to meet people necessarily online. You know, it's a huge country, so there certainly are plenty of people meeting people in physical venues like bars, and certainly people meet people online. But there's a fair number of people who the only way you may be able to reach them is where they're going to meet partners for sex, because they're not necessarily ever going to go home with that partner or develop a stable relationship with that partner. So I think a lot of this is conversations between people who are seeing people who already have become infected in the healthcare system, and cultural social scientists trying to figure out where do you start making inroads in each setting.
In terms of data gaps, this is one of the issues as well, that, you know, we have data from a series of different low middle income countries, about 50, and there's about 94 countries that we don't have any data from. So then the issue is, are there no gay men in those countries, or are there no men at risk? And likely the answer is, you know, that's not true. But, you know, the approach that we've taken has been sort of a two-pronged approach. First is always identifying a community group that wants to do this work. We really do value this issue, you know, this concept of like us supporting community groups. We never, you'll never see like media releases from us, or, you know, where we get ahead of the community in terms of messaging. Our role is very technical in what it is that we do. So we identify community groups, and generally speaking, we haven't come across a country ranging from the Congo to Guinea-Bissau, where we've done our most recent work, where there hasn't been a community group that is interested in doing this work. And that they're sort of, you know, they have other jobs and they have other ways of supporting themselves, but they're interested in supporting their community. In the same way that, you know, I wasn't all around, but, you know, in the early, late 70s and 80s, this is what happened in New York, people sort of sticking up for their own communities. So in terms of doing that, the approach that we've taken is providing technical support for them to do these studies. So doing epidemiological assessments to get at least some baseline data to be able to make a case for prevention programs. So the first prong is about developing these studies that tend to be very simple, difficult to implement and operationalize, but simple in concept. And then the second approach is applying for funding, larger scale funding, to put forward prevention programs. It is very difficult. I mean, I wish that we could sort of apply for funding from a rights perspective, but realistically, rights funding is incredibly limited. So, I mean, there's groups that give sort of $2,000 to $5,000 grants, you know, around like Astrea, a wonderful organization. Even the MSM initiative is incredibly important, but they give $10,000 to $15,000 grants. It's very difficult for people to support themselves with a $15,000 programmatic grant. So, you know, I mean, unfortunately, but realistically, the money lies in HIV prevention programming, making sure that they can have access to PEPFAR monies, global fund monies, and other sources of expenditures that should be allocated to them. So the first approach is where there's no data, we look at developing a data set. And the second approach is facilitating them advocating to the global fund. And you know, we could get into more details about how they advocate to the global fund because it's sort of a funny system. But and to, you know, organizations like the US government and other governments, while they're smaller chunks, other governments tend to be a little bit more progressive in how they fund these sort of issues. And moving forward and developing prevention programming, getting more data from that, and then sort of continuing to make this case.
One quick point, you raised the young gas indicators, and thank you for raising it. What it's really important to look at and to analyze what exactly the numbers that you're looking at, as Steph pointed out. The young gas indicators, which are the basis for that graph that I showed, are not the world's best indicators. They're probably the world's worst indicators, because a lot of those reports that countries submit are, they come from the country itself with very minimum community engagement, although they say they do community engagement. A lot of those reports, if you start reading them, say that they're reaching 100% of the MSM. Some are saying that they have no MSM in their country. So you definitely have to, you know, read them with a grain of salt, but also, and as Steph has said, a lot of the research that we know is because of the research that Hopkins and other groups have done in many settings, you've got to compare those different data sets and look at that. But yeah, absolutely. Thanks for raising the point about the young gas indicators. Yeah.
Yes.
So is your question about the U.S. or international?
No, the other countries that you're referring to.
So the question about how to develop prevention programming, that's what I'm hearing, right? And so we've dealt with this in terms of there's two main approaches, right? We either mainstream services, so we include services for LGBT or MSM in, you know, mainstream clinics, or develop sort of these vertical clinics, like in Thailand, for example. They have, you know, they have a nice clinic. The CDC runs a beautiful clinic where they do this, where you can do this. I think the answer is that we're likely in the early stages going to have to mainstream these services in traditional health clinics, and it's because there's too much risk in associated at this stage with developing sort of specific and targeted clinics. But in order to do that, we need to find people who are willing to provide those services. And Ken and I and the Physicians for Human Rights were involved in a proposal to really launch out health sector interventions. And so we use the Fenway Guide. There's a few other guides that are more Africa specific about how to train healthcare workers to be more open and more willing to seek services, because our own data has told us, and I didn't have an opportunity to speak about this today, but you know, many people are denied healthcare services. They even try to seek them, they're denied them, and we know that that's associated with increased HIV risk, not only HIV risk practices, but actually HIV infection itself. Lower rates of testing, lower rates of condom use. So I mean, you know, there needs to be this bilateral or, you know, trilateral effort focused on, or multilateral effort, I should say, focused on structural level issues. Because we know that even if PrEP gets rolled out, even if, let's say, PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, chemoprophylaxis is successful, that if we tried rolling out chemoprophylaxis in Malawi tomorrow, there would be no benefit to it, right? Because you're not in the community to be able to get at people. First of all, to get to pre-exposure prophylaxis and even a post-exposure prophylaxis, you have to test and treat. You have to get people into testing. So people don't have the social capital or the wherewithal to be able to do that and to engage the community. And what we're putting forward is that you need to increase social capital, you need to increase opportunities for people so as to then sort of set the stage for biomedical interventions. That while structural interventions may be more difficult to evaluate, they're clearly a necessary component. Biomedical interventions in their absence will likely be a very benefit whatsoever. I think that's an incredibly important component. I don't know, it's something that, you know, we just finished our bank report, this like 400-page book, novel, on MSM issues in low and middle income countries. And, you know, I mean, we didn't answer the question about like how to roll out services in the majority of the settings. We can draw on examples like Thailand, we can draw on other pieces, but we don't know what the answer is country by country. And I think that's sort of the next step, and we're gonna sort of have to see how things play out over the next 2 to 5 years in terms of, you know, what happens. Are there gonna be continued arrests? Are African leaders gonna run on this issue to get elected, you know, and if so, just sort of propagate the social stigma, or are they gonna do as other leaders are doing and sort of embrace the issue and say, you know, human rights for all? I think that will, to some extent, you know, affect the levels of success that we have, both in terms of the research that we do, but also prevention services.
I fully agree with what Steph said, but I also think that the world is a very heterogeneous place, and there are these glimmers of light in some countries where there actually are community organizations that are saying that they'd like to build an MSM health program or even more broadly an LGBT health program. And again, they tend to be more in the middle income countries rather than really resource constrained settings, but not necessarily in places that are typical of the local epidemic. So for example, in South Africa, there is an MSM sexual health clinic in Cape Town that's really doing good work and has the ability to potentially scale up. And you know, Cape Town is not Lusaka, is not Kampala, but it is in Africa, and perhaps eventually there might be ability to do more training that goes on site. Certainly in Brazil, there are a number of programs that are very, comprehensive MSM focused. Thailand as well. In Mumbai, there's a wonderful program, Humps for Our Trust, that's increasingly offering a wider array of services for sexual gender minority health. Again, a lot of these programs are very much built on, you know, HIV prevention funding, but many of the leaders are getting it and trying to see how they can address the larger frame of issues for MSM and then for the wider sexual gender minority community. In many of these countries also, transgender individuals are particularly vulnerable to HIV, so there's already the thinking it's not just male-identified MSMs who should be the appropriate individuals or the consumers of the services. So I think it's a scary time because of some of the pushback, but I think it's a very exciting time in terms of how some of these groups are starting to grow organically.
And I think this might be the final question for the session. Thank you. And why don't I now invite the final question for our panelists? Perhaps someone who hasn't asked a question, but if there's a burning question, if there isn't, I'll come back to you, Tom. Anyone? Okay, Tom.
Well, I wanted to ask actually about tourism and about the notion, whether there are any countries that have the notion that the AIDS is a foreigner's disease and, or that has been kind of high. The threat of the disease that is no longer
issue. And in fact, and then if there are countries where tourism is a significant source of
transmission. And the band played on 2011 to 2015 in other countries, is that summary?
So I think the answer is all of them in which I work, right? So I mean, especially among gay men. We should separate sort of HIV in the general population and that among gay men. Every time we present these results, it's always like that they always pick the touristy part of their place, and they'll be like, these are boys serving the tourists that are coming in from wherever. Or these are people who have been to South Africa, especially in like a place like Zambia or Botswana or Lesotho. They've gone to South Africa and they've been sort of proselytized in gay culture, and then they come back and bring it home. And so we always ask very specific questions around, like, who are you, and we always find in our samples, it's like, our samples tend to be sort of 99% domestic born in whatever country and have never left the country. And that's probably the most important thing to make that case, that these are not, other people that are here on vacation for a week, and that's who we're sampling and that's who we're finding. That these are, if we're in Zambia, these are Zambians. They're Chichewa-speaking, Lusaka-born Zambians. And, and they likely have not left Zambia. And they likely have not been to South Africa. And so I think that is something that we deal with that in every place in which we work. I mean, in terms of foreigners, there are places, sex tourism is still a major issue. And, I mean, there's places like, Cape Verde, we're starting, Cabo Verde off the coast of West Africa, we're starting another project where it's very common for Portuguese to go down there, Portuguese white men to go down there and have male sexual partners. And so, I don't think that we shouldn't sort of hide away from that. We should embrace that and understand why that's happening and how to, at least protect people and make sure they're aware of how to protect themselves when having sex. Because a lot of those men, don't want to use condoms and they don't want to use lubricant, they want lube and they don't want condoms. And so, that's an issue that, we're sort of embracing. But in the majority of Southern Africa, that's not an issue. It's not a tourism issue. West Africa, it's likely a little bit different.
Well, I want to take this moment to just thank Gerard, Steph, and Ken for such a fascinating discussion. Hopefully next year we'll be able to take the big X off of your presentation. And thank you all for staying and for this wonderful discussion. Thank you.